Hello, my name is Jack, and you're listening to Working in TV. Hello, how is everyone? How are you all doing? So a little bit of a different show today. I thought I would do a show to try and promote TV and film as a career, not a hobby. Because there's been a lot of stuff going around in the press, in the media recently about what the Chancellor said about people in unviable industries should retrain and should do something else. So I just thought I'd get a few clips together to, maybe to highlight just that this is not a hobby, what we do. It's an important job culturally. It's an important job financially. I mean, we provide a shit ton of money to the economy. So when people say, do something else, it pisses us off. So I thought I'd select a few clips that kind of show how we who work in this industry, how we view it, or how we should view it. Okay, here we go.
Whenever people say what I do, I say, oh, I work in telly, and I kind of almost throw it away as a sentence.
Exactly.
And I think this country, you know, I think our government, and the reason why, you know, going back to the whole, you know, self-employed people falling through the cracks financially during the pandemic is because this successive governments view our industry as a hobby. They just see it as they don't see it as a proper job.
No.
You go to America, America isn't great at, you know, lots of things, as you know, as we know, but the one thing they seem to nail, that they refer to the film in, it is the industry, it is a job. There are whole towns, you know, built up around this profession, and you know, we as a country and a government and even us ourselves working in it are almost a little bit throwaway about how we view our role and how we refer to ourselves. I think, you know, that maybe there is a bit of, we should be a bit more upfront about it. And, you know, but I, as I said, I'm really guilty of it. I kind of laugh it off whenever somebody asks me what I do, like it's a little old bit of nothing, you know. It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's the same. It's the same for me as well. Like, at, you know, dinner parties or whatever, you know, someone says, what do you do?
We'll get you going to dinner parties.
Oh God, I really don't dinner, but I hate saying that. I keep saying it. But like, you know, if you go anywhere and someone says, oh, what do you do? And then, it's just an awkward 5 minutes where they don't know what you do specifically with my job. And like you said about people,
thinking, television sets, what do you design TVs?
Exactly. But no, you're right. There doesn't seem to be that community thing in, like, Hollywood has its history and its industry and it's self-sufficient. I remember reading an article, I can't remember who it was by or where it was, but I remember someone said there is no film industry in the UK.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist because we're so reliant on Hollywood coming to us, you know, and Star Wars and even, you know, places like Pinewood. They probably would survive without it, but they don't feel like they can. And they're even owned, like studios now are owned by Disney.
Yeah.
And they pretty much Pinewood, I don't know this for a fact, but it feels like Pinewood is now Disney.
Yes, that's my understanding. They've basically got first choice on using it. As far as I know, I could be wrong. And I mean, obviously they've got to, we should quantify that. I don't know that for certain, but my understanding is that they're first choice in the way that Netflix have got, Shepperton, I think. So they've kind of got first choice on it if a job comes in. But it's you say all of that. Still, when every time I walk to go into Pinewood Studios, I get goosebumps. And you know, I think all of us are kind of quite dismissive of it, and yet it matters immensely to people working in the business. Just talking earlier about the BBC and when that all sort of folded, I don't think I've ever come closer to shedding a tear for a building. It really got me that. And I think it's partly because it's where I started my career. And I grew up watching all the output that building produced when I was growing up in the 70s, where I just fell in love with telly you know, in all its guises. And, you know, when they used to go behind the scenes on Swap Shop on a Saturday morning and you'd see the studio walls and occasionally they'd run to another studio. And you, I used to get so excited about that, seeing the mechanics of it. So, yeah.
Behind the magician's curtain, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just, you know, and it's the same with Pinewood. I grew up, like all of us, watching, you know, the Bond movies. And the first time you see the Bond stage is a proper, it's a tick box moment for me. It's a shed. It's a shed with James, with 007 written on the side. But
yeah, with some mouldy old insulation.
Absolutely. There's nothing more than it. That cows sleep in better rooms than that shed. But, but it's history, and you're there and you're living and breathing the same air that all these amazing movies have been made. Tesco's in Elstree, where the Shining maze was. You know, every time I walk into that Tesco's, I just think, well, this is where the Shining was made. It's not Tesco's. Yes. This is where the hotel was. It's just extraordinary.
I think you touched on something with that Tesco's thing, is that maybe it's a British sort of modesty thing, but it feels like we don't celebrate our industry or our history at all with regards to TV and film, because there's so many, like Kubrick shot here, like exclusively pretty much, and like Isle of Dogs for, you know, Full Metal Jacket.
And all I remember at the time. I remember because I used to live over that way.
All these giant things that have happened here and all the Bond stuff, and the Star Wars is essentially English film, really, when you think about it. But we don't, and it shows with the government now, you know, not to get political again, but I always do. But like, it shows with the government now how they're treating us, the people who create culture, essentially, you know, a big chunk of at least.
Yeah.
And we just, one, we don't have enough respect for ourselves and what we do. And two, we don't get any kind of recognition from the government or any kind of help. And it's sad, because when it's all said and done, like, you look back at your childhood and, you know, the history of the country, and comedians and actors and writers, and these are the things that people remember.
Music,
and
our music industry is
exactly the big cultural moments of the 20th century are all TV, film, music. It's not about really about politics or geography or history of buildings and all this kind of stuff. It's the creative content that we've made, and we're a small island, and we produce consistently the best actors, we produce the best film crews, we produce the best musicians, the best writers, the best poets, the best everything, but we don't appreciate
it. True.
We don't support it in any way.
Yeah, because we're so self-deprecating. We're so kind of just...
Because when someone asks us what we do, we go, I work in TV a bit, maybe. Yeah. And because we're freelancers, because it is so precarious and the job is so hard and it's so tiring and it takes us away from our families and our kids and our wives. And then maybe that's why we have this sort of conflicted relationship with it, because we both love it. We love it. We need it. We hate it, but we don't want it, but we do want it. Do you know what I mean? We're sort of self-reliant and addicted, but also, anyway, kept down by it. But I think that's...
I think that's it. I think we've nailed it.
Or were you working at all when the lockdown came in?
Yeah, so I was supposed to be doing some filming over in the UK for Neighbours. They tried to come over to the UK once a year from a storyline point of view, and that they were coming over for a four-day job. So we had 2 days in London, and then we were popping over to Ireland for 2 days as well. And that was, that was my next job. And then lockdown hit, and they pulled out pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't mentioned this to anyone before, actually. I was going to work on an Indian production, and they were coming to London. I know it was going to be quite fair. It wasn't Bollywood or anything like that. It was like a emotional drama kind of thing, but they were scheduled to come for 2 weeks to London. And it was my first job for a long while, actually, because I got married at the back end of last year. And I kind of took a bit of time off, because you know what it's like working in the summer. In drama, it's pretty much summer. You work in the summer and then you don't work until March, April again. So I'd kind of done my summer. And it was September. I got married in October, and I was like, okay, cool. I'll take a bit of time, and then that's fine. And then, so yeah, I haven't worked since October. So it's, but I had that in that job from the Indian production, and yeah, I went to visit my parents in France, and then the lockdown happened while I was in France, and then, which was pretty crazy because they were locked down a week before us.
That's right. Yeah.
And then, yeah, I got the call about the job, and I was like, jeez, because they were like, we just can't get to you from India. It just didn't even, it was a non-starter.
No, it's funny you should say about that, because I had a really good sort of September, October, November, which was great. You know, I was really, really busy. Yeah. That was for BBC Horizon. And then December hit and the work disappeared.
Yeah.
And then in January, I was thinking there's not much coming up. So I've been putting off having operations on my knee to cut some dodgy old cartilage out.
Yeah.
So I thought, right, I'll get that done in January, which I did. And I think, you know, by the end of January, I should be fine and up and working by the beginning of February. But then February was really, really quiet. And things just started to happen towards the end of February, beginning of March. I thought, great, it's picking up.
Yeah, it really was the worst timing. I mean, obviously it's horrible and, you know, people are dying and it's an awful thing to happen. But in terms of timing for the TV industry, especially for drama, it really could not have been a worse week, because we had all survived winter and spring. I mean, for anyone who doesn't know, pretty much TV is kind of dormant in the winter just for light reasons, really, for, you know, for weather conditions and all that kind of stuff. And then, like March, April is kind of when it all kicks off again. And for us, for that to happen, it really meant that we were all depleted for everything, really. For like, we'd spent so much time at home and we'd got, you know,
exactly.
With that, you kind of happy to get back to work, as it were. And financially, I know a lot of us are still struggling, obviously. But yeah, we were all kind of like, okay, cool. You know, we've kind of got to the end of our reserves, as it were. So it sounds crazy, but that it just is how it works, isn't it, really? And every year, every year we all try and say the same thing to ourselves. Oh, well, next year is not going to be the same. It's not going to be so hard for me at the winter. I'm going to try and save, or I'm going to try and come up with something else to do. But then inevitably it ends up being. But so, yeah, it was real kind of like, oh, my God, what's going to happen now? Because there's going to be no film.
It would have been really interesting to see what would have happened if lockdown had happened maybe 2 or 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
Because I think many of us would have been on jobs already. And the jobs would have been committed to. So, in effect, once lockdown lifted, we would have had a job to come back to.
Yeah, and also it would have helped with anyone PAYE as well for furlough reasons and stuff, because there's a lot. I mean, this is another conversation, maybe for another day. But there's a whole thing in TV about freelancers with self-employed and PAYE statuses, and there's a whole campaign about the forgotten PAYE freelancers and all this stuff, and I'll put a link in this show. I'll put a link to some articles.
Yeah, I'm part of that as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, well then, yeah. Tell you what, let's talk about that. So, what have you been doing towards that?
I mean, to be honest, it's mainly just trying to get the message out there, banging the drum. You know, it's through no fault of our own, the way that the industry has required us to be set up, i.e., in my instance, a limited company. We get absolutely zero support whatsoever. So all I've been doing is basically emailing my MP, who is as useful as a chocolate teapot.
Name and shame, James. Name and shame.
Claire Coutinho in Tandridge. Useless.
There you go, Claire. Claire, step it up. Come on.
Yeah.
People need you.
No empathy whatsoever. And just spouting that, oh, we've done this, we've done that, we've done this.
That's the thing.
It hasn't helped me at all.
Yeah, exactly. You've done all this other stuff that's completely unrelated to it. Yeah, that seems to be the thing that I'm seeing a lot, is that people are just getting zero sympathy for the fact that they are pretty soon destitute because they have zero income.
Yeah,
they have all this, you know, because like I mentioned before, we speculate to accumulate and all this kind of thing. We have, and yourself and me included, we have a lot of equipment. We have a lot of overheads kind of thing, and suddenly to not be able to work. And I mean, from my point of view, I've been self-employed, not limited company. So I've kind of managed to barely scrape by during this. I'm having to do this to give myself a potential chance at another revenue and, you know, also to keep my mind active. But yeah, but limited companies and just the lack of empathy, because you guys just, there's just nothing. It's
no, I mean, the thing that bugs me the most is that we've been portrayed as a bunch of money grabbing, non-tax paying people. But in reality, the difference between myself as a limited company and somebody who's a freelancer is about £2,000, which if you take into consideration, we don't get holiday pay, we don't get sick pay. £2,000 does, you know, if I've got 2 weeks off of work, £2,000 as a tax-free dividend does not cover.
No.
It doesn't even cover a week of not being employed. But and the other thing is that it's not through our fault that we're limited companies.
Yeah, exactly.
It's how we get work, it's how the industry prefers us to be.
Yeah. That's the real kicker, because that they've created this problem for you, essentially. Because if it was left to you, then you probably wouldn't do it this way, and you'd have other ways to do it, and therefore, you know, you'd have help from the government, which it's very bizarre, and I don't understand, and I don't think the government understands freelancers in this. Maybe other industries they understand it more, but in TV they really cannot. And I've had conversations with HMRC about this on the phone about tax and things, and they really cannot understand how you, if you're, and I'm talking about PAYE now for a second, like if you work for a company as PAYE, they think that you work for that company and that is your job, like you work for them. But they don't realize that PAYE short-term contracts, there's millions of people doing this, and they don't, it's just not something they're aware of. Like they must be, because they must be issuing P45s by the dozen for people in a year, and I don't know how they can't understand that that is a way to work, and people need help, because it doesn't work for them in any way. Being PAYE on short-term contracts, you get nothing. You get no advantages. You can't declare anything.
You must be constantly on emergency tax codes anyway.
They are, yeah. I mean, I don't do that. I do self-employed. But yeah, but I think they are. And they're everyone I've ever, and most people on TV sets are, I think, on PAYE, because there's specific rules. Like the government say that if you don't have your own equipment and or to a certain amount, like production managers always ask me on every job I do, they say, oh, we need a kit list of £5,000 or more, and we need to know this and this, otherwise you have to go as PAYE, even though this job could be halfway through my year and completely ruin my tax and have to explain everything when I do my thing. I just don't understand it. And
I mean, also, if you take someone like the BBC, they will only employ somebody for 9 months, because after that, then become a proper, they have to be PAYE. So we're in this situation because it's convenient for companies like the BBC and ITV. It's convenient for them. It's a way of them not paying as much for people to do the work.
Yeah, it comes down to them not having to pay us national insurance and do all this kind of stuff, and to give us holiday and to give us the rights and protections that everyone else gets, really. And it's all for their benefit.
Yeah, but I would say the whole industry is set up in this way. So it's very rare that you get a staff job. I don't know that there are probably staff jobs anymore. I mean, at the sort of the higher production side of things, but it's termed from our side of the industry, Jack, I don't think there's... there isn't any. So we have to be self-employed. We have to be limited companies. There's no other option.
Yeah. And with that comes, we all have to be our own accountants. We all have to be our own PR department. We all have to be everything. And I think that's another thing that people don't realize. When you run your own limited company, you are the company, you on your own. So I think people that go from jobs being employed and then going to be limited, their own limited company, they suddenly realize, oh my God, there's no one else to help me with this. I have to figure it out. And you end up just losing money because you don't know things, which is a fast learning curve, because you have to. But yeah, I think at the moment, I think TV in that sense is broken and people are suffering.
Yeah, no, I think there needs to be, post this situation, in lockdown, there needs to be a good look at how the industry works. And I, you know, I've spent most of lockdown battling this, and I don't know the answer. All I know is that what is coming from the government is going to smack us really hard.
Yeah.
And I personally think there's going to be a massive brain drain within the industry. I think, you know, I'm sorry to say this for your listeners, but I think there's going to be a massive brain drain. People are going to leave the industry.
Yeah, I agree. I think, yeah, I think when you look at it from, yeah, you look at it from that side, the quality of everything is going to go down because everyone's going to be less experienced because people are going to try and come in, chance their arm and try and step up and do all this kind of stuff. It might be good for some people, but yeah, yeah. They're going to lose a lot of professional experienced people, and just the mental health of people is going to be incredibly affected by this because it's not healthy to have to fight this long just to survive.
Yeah, no, it's not. I think that's going to be probably the biggest impact after lockdown is going to be the mental health of people, because the forums that I'm on,
yeah,
people are, you know, I mean, we're talking people down from committing suicide.
No, I agree. I've not done that myself, but I've read the messages and I've seen people quite literally crying with their words of, you know, their fathers and mothers and people that just cannot support their family. And it's not the problem is, and I don't want to get too political about it really, but it's a choice for the government to do this. It's not, there is something they can do. Do you know what I mean? It's not like a tornado came and loads of people lose their job. They can do something if they want to. And
it's a political systematic decision to exclude us from help. It is that simple. For them to say that they can't, I mean, this is just being selfish from my point of view, is it my situation. The fact that they can't work out how much dividends I pay myself.
Yeah.
It is appalling, you know.
But how can they not? You've been giving them that information for years.
And just to clarify, the fact that I'm paying dividends is not 100% not a tax dodge.
No.
It is because we've said it earlier in this chat that our work and our income is so sporadic and so seasonal that I can't guarantee that I'm going to have enough money in my bank account to pay myself PAYE wage in December, January, February. Just when I earn nothing.
No, exactly. So, and that's how, that's the misconception. I think that's what's kept the government being addressed on this by the public in general, is that misconception that limited companies are tax dodgers. And it's just not true, for one. And to accuse people of that itself feels like a criminal act. Do you know what I mean? Because if we did that, if limited companies didn't pay tax and they just took the money out and just said, screw you to the taxman, they would be in jail. They would be in prison. They would not be heads of limited companies. So for anyone who is the head of a limited company, has been for years, is obviously not doing that because they would have been stopped. So that's just an argument that needs to just die and go away. And then we can just, and I think that is why they get away with it, the government, because they're not being challenged by, there's not a, the hearts and minds of this thing is not with the limited companies, it's with the government. And they seem to be just coasting along on that.
But the final point on it, I guess, is it's a tax system that's been set up by the government. So we're not breaking any rules.
No, exactly. That's it as well. We're having to dance their dance. And then because we're doing their dance, they're saying, you don't get anything. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a swindle.
Yes. Moving on before people turn off.
Two grumpy men moan about tax. What a podcast that is. my next question is, have you worked during this thing? Have you done anything, days here and there on anything during the new normal?
The new normal, yes. I did a three-day job on a pilot for a new game show.
Okay.
And it was interesting just from a term of how you can work in a big team and social distance. And that in itself, I think, is almost impossible what we do. Just to because I mean, you know, the pace that we normally work at is quite frantic and quite, you know, in your face, isn't it? It's always, you know, move.
Yeah.
But in order to social distance, everybody has to slow right down. So, you know, whereas I would be around a camera setting up my audio stuff at the same time that they're tweaking lenses and doing, now that can't happen.
No, so there's an order, yeah.
There's a whole order of things that has to be followed. But then that comes back to the production company and the exec producers and the producers. Can they allow that time to happen?
Yeah.
And there was because it was a pilot and then we pushed for time, there was a certain element of, well, no, we can't do that.
Yeah.
So there were, you know, rules broken at that point, which to me was a bit, I could see why it was happening, and there's a part of my brain that is okay with that happening, but then there's another part of me thinking, moving forward from this point, we can't do this. This is not sustainable.
Yeah, that's the as soon as all these new rules and new ways of working, because I read the report that came out and all the guidelines and everything, like I'm sure you did, and the first thing I'd noticed was that just how long everything's going to take, and the one thing you don't do in TV production is take a long time to do anything, and that's your first rule. It's an instinct based job. You have to be prepared. You have to know what's going to happen next. You have to know what you're doing there and what this person's doing, and you have to squeeze in and tweak something, because if you wait your turn, then they're waiting on you. And my rule in TV is don't let them be waiting on you. And
that's on my website. I never want to hear waiting for sound. So you're always thinking, you know, the next step ahead. What's going to happen next? I'm going to preempt it.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things to this, because that's our instincts, and we've trained ourselves to be that, and that's what makes us. That's a part of what makes us good at our job, being able to do things without anyone noticing and getting it done, so they can just roll straight from this to that without going, okay, this, and then this. So you just, you crack on with it. And that instinct is probably going to take from their side as well to expect it. And from our side to do it, it's going to take a long time to break that habit.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've seen you work, and you work the same way as I do, that, you know, the first AD will say, can you do this? And then you just look at them and say, I've already done it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how you and I normally work.
Yeah.
And I think there's a real mindset change that is going to have to happen. And I don't know how that's going to happen.
Yeah. What is your favourite scene that you've been involved in, involving special effects?
Okay, so I think my favourite scene of all time was on a job called Relic.
Okay.
And we had to, it was this room that we had to set ablaze. So we had fire bards basically all over this room, in every corner, along every wall. You know, it was rigged up to the max. And of course, when you're inside and you're doing a big room burn, you've got to think about the safety side of it. So what we do is we have a gas bottle for every gas line that we have, and you'd have dedicated people to that bottle to get to that particular flame. You know, so everybody has to be really organized in this. And if there are people running around and it's hectic and it's crazy, as soon as you're doing something like this. And we also had a stunt burn as well. So everything on set starts to calm down, and we all take our time and we start to understand our cues, understand where people are going to be walking. So everything is planned out sort of to the max. Yeah, we had to set this room alight. And in those situations, you have the gas bottle that you can control. So you can flame up, flame down. You know, as soon as they shout cut, all the flames go off. You check the area to make sure that it hasn't set anything else alight.
Oh, right, yeah.
So not only were we doing a burning room, we also had to then do a stunt burn. So the stunt man and woman got Zel gelled, so fireproofing gel, all over their body. And then they had to put on this like rubber hands and rubber face, rubber head. and everything to go on top. We also then, they'd turn over the camera first, and then we'd spray them down with a little bit of flammable liquid.
Yeah.
So that way, as soon as they walk into the flame, they're obviously going to get set alight. And as they get through the first room, which is ablaze, into the corridor scene, we then set off a fireball down the corridor. So it's, for me, it was the most exciting day because it's serious, you know. It's scary if something goes wrong. Of course. If you're in a situation where you trust everybody that you're working with, and obviously you trust the supervisor and they trust you, and it's handled calmly, it can go perfectly. And, you know, everything works out exactly as it needs to be. The stunt people don't get hurt. The effect looks good. And it's all done under safe conditions. Yeah. And for the Relic show, it was fantastic. I think it was a one-take wonder.
It was a
one-shot wonder.
Well, that's what you hope for, isn't it, when you do something big and fire, and you want it to be a oneer because you don't want to have to
recreate what you just did.
Well, yeah, exactly. And also you don't want to, you don't want to have all this hype and all these weeks of conversations about it, and then it go nothing really happened, or there'd be a bit of a delay. If you just get it done, take one, everyone loves it, perfect.
Yeah.
And you don't have to do it again.
Yeah, then you go, pat on the back, great.
Exactly. All everyone right, loves you, you're a hero.
And I de-rig it.
And you're like, oh, and then they hate you again because it takes an hour to de-rig.
One of the things that I got told by a lot of people, which is bad advice, was be a bad runner, because they said be a bad runner and then you will not be a runner anymore, and then you will be what you want to be. But I think having some pride in the work you do, even if you are a runner, is so important. You know, some
of that is really bad advice.
Yeah, really bad advice. I think there's a fear of being stuck in the same job for a long time.
Yeah.
And as a runner, I've had this conversation with people all the time, you know, when's my promotion happening? You know, when am I going to be moving up in the world? And I have these thoughts myself, you know, when am I going to, you know, move from that researcher talent pool and actually work as a researcher?
Yeah.
There's another voice in my head saying, you know, enjoy where you are now. You're not going to be a runner forever. And being a runner comes with learning so much about the job that you're doing. I was speaking to a prod cohort about this, and she said that, you know, as a runner, you meet everyone on production. There's nothing better than that. And you're not going to experience that any other time than when you're a runner. And, you know, have some pride in the work that you do, even if you are at the bottom.
Plentiful was a really good example because everybody on the series when I joined it was film. All of them are kind of this, you know, the Spielbergs and the Star Wars and all the rest of it. But 24 is television. And the thing that's peculiar to television that film genuinely doesn't know how to deal with is that television doesn't have scripts ready. And 24 in particular are particularly bad at having stuff available. So, for example, I did 4 episodes of 24 and I did the finale. Some executive in the States had made the very interesting decision to start airing the series while we were still making it. Now, bear in mind, this is an action show with a star that's 50. You know, it's like that was brave, if you want to use that word anyway. Mm. But then they aired 4 episodes before I started episode 7. So by the time we got to the end, you know, the last 2, 11 and 12... the only thing that anybody cared about was the episode number because it was literally on air. So I think we wrapped episode 12 and episode 12 aired in the States 10 days later. It was the worst turnaround I've ever seen. But we didn't have the scripts for 11 and 12 when I started prepping them 12 days before we shot them. Now to the film crew. Their head blew off. They were like, well, we can't, you know, they were like, this is impossible. How can you possibly be so calm? We haven't got a script. I'm like, I know, we never have a script. You know, so actually it weirdly fell to my advantage. They couldn't comprehend how you could even start prepping anything without what's on the page. It's like, but no, we know certain things. We know Stephen Fry is the Prime Minister. We know he will only work at this location because that's where we've always seen him.
Yeah.
We have to check when Stephen's available and when that location is available, and we just have to book them. And
yeah,
therefore,
exactly.
you it's amazing how much you can do without the words. And also, when the words are so late, as an AD, you have a far greater influence on how the final product runs, because you're basically saying, well, I can't give you that. You will have to put that scene in this space, because that's the only space I've got available in the schedule. So it actually allows ADs, you know, we're a non-creative role largely, but allows you far more input into the final piece when it's that mental. Whereas film, to get the money at all, has to have a locked script, because the investors are basically saying, I'm putting my money into these words on this page. And the minute you change that, I'm out.
Yeah, I'm paying you to make
this
that
script right here and not a word different. So it's been there for 8 months and it's one, and everybody knows one story very, very well. So of course they're prepped within an inch of their life, and they've done 6 months of costume fittings and the rest of it, because they've had the work in front of them for so long. So
the continuity of it all manages to become a lot easier because you're not jumping. You're not at this location jumping. Okay, so now this is 6 months later because this is episode 4, but then episode 2 will go back. So we need to take the scar off his face, and then we need to have him in this costume. Yeah. So I agree that film. Oh God, it must be such a luxury. It's such a nice thing to have a text.
Yes, exactly. But that's all that the film world knows. Unless you do the big Tom Cruise things where he and Russell Crowe, and they come in and they rewrite it every day. But then they know that that's what those particular stars do. So then they go, that's fine. But that was, so 24 was really interesting because weirdly, I was the only one that was sort of calm in that. They were just kind of going, we have no idea how you're doing this. And it's like, this is normal. And they were like,
I mean, that must two things really. That must be really good for you in your mind as your satisfaction, because you must be able to go, oh, I can show people that I can do this and I can nail it and get it all great. And also that must be great for your reputation because they've gone, how the hell are you doing this? And you're like, well, because this is what I do.
Yes.
So they must think, oh wow, she's like incredible, but it's you know, I'm sure you are, but it's like, it's just, it's because that's the training you've had and you've had to do that. So
yes, however so I did 24 in 2014, so 6 years later, for example. I've just bumped into my third on 24, who's a very talented man, but you know, he's first in the second unit of Batman. So do you see what I mean? Those worlds, we don't mix. The film is the last I want to say the last bastion of snobbery. I don't really mean it like that, because that suggests they're not lovely people, and most of them absolutely are. But they do not trust, they still don't trust telly, and they never have, you know. And so even though, you know, some of the best scripts in the world are coming through television.
Hello again. So that's the show. So like I said before, I selected those clips because I thought they would help highlight just how people working in TV and film, how do we view it and how much we appreciate it and how much we value it, really. Anyway, so next week we'll be back with a guest. Normal service will resume. So that all that leaves me to say is thank you for listening. And if you would like to, please subscribe to us so you don't miss an episode. Give us a review, maybe, if you like. A rating, 5 stars, if you feel like we deserve it. And we will see you again next week. Okay, take care of yourselves. Cheers. Bye. Oh yeah, one more thing. This song goes out to the Chancellor.